about that.
Oh, Nate.
Hey, Nate. Hey, Nate.
Nathan.
Hey, how's it going?
There he is.
Hey.
I was afraid you stood us up.
I thought it was 2:30. It wasn't. And you even sent me a nice reminder email. I was just wrong. Daddy Brain.
Right.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you could join us. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. You might get a cameo from Robin.
I'm okay with that.
Awesome.
Hello and welcome to episode 234 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, and back from paternity leave, sort of, I'm Nate Mavis. And with me, from Laughlin, Nevada, is Carlos Welch.
And Andrew?
Yes, I was ready.
You're going to let me do it. Okay. Yeah, I'm Andrew Brokus.
Where are you?
In Catonsville, Maryland.
All right.
How's it going, Carlos?
Oh, there he is already.
Hey, good.
So, Rob. I'm taking on all the extra responsibilities in life that you're actively avoiding. So,
you know what, man? Somebody's got to do it.
life's good?
Life is great, man. Life is
fantastic.
Great.
Fantastic. Glad to hear it. You sound fantastic.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy.
Great.
Good to talk to you guys. I don't think I've talked to you guys in a while.
No, I think it it's been since Vegas, or maybe we talked. I guess we did one episode since then, but yeah, it's been a while.
Right.
Yeah, are you happy about anything in particular, or just happy?
Just happy the sun is shining, you know. my little internet setup is working well. I was a little bit worried about that, but according to you guys, I'm coming through loud and clear.
Yeah, you sound fine to me. What's your setup?
So I'm staying in a hotel in, actually it's Laughlin. It's like right on the line between Bullhead City, where I was originally staying with Alex, but Alex left. I went to this hotel in Laughlin, and the internet there isn't great for, like I'm fine for like playing online, surfing the internet, all the download type stuff. But if I need to stream or do a coaching session or do a podcast, the upload speed isn't that great there. So I have to get in the van and drive like half a mile up the hill. And at the top of the hill, I get a better reception, usually. And I tried to stream a couple of days ago, and it didn't work well. So I was a little bit worried about this, but it seems fine as long as I'm not doing video, I guess.
Yeah, it seems fine to me. You guys okay with using all this, or do you want to do like a proper introduction and all that kind of stuff?
Anything that involves Carlos driving around in his van to do like better streaming and stuff needs to stay. The people want to know that.
Excellent.
Agreed. I was thinking about Nate today. I think the last time we did an episode, this may have been more than one episode ago, but Nate had a question. He's like, "So what do you see out of your windshield?" And at the time, it was like, I was like parking in.
Yeah, you were in a parking ride, yeah.
Yeah, a parking ride for like the Atlanta Metro Transit, and there was like a fence and like some trees blocking my view, and like, you know, a little bit of view of the interstate. But now in Laughlin, it's just beautiful, man. Like I can see, I'm in Laughlin at the top of the hill, so I can look down and see almost the entire Bullhead City. And then there's mountains in the background. I can see the river. There's actually like sunshine and palm trees. So yeah, much better view this time.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. And yeah, I do remember that being a pretty area. I mean, I didn't, when we came to visit you, I didn't really know a whole lot about that area. And to drive from Las Vegas down to Laughlin is not a real impressive drive.
Right.
But then when you arrive there, yeah, it's this cool like little river valley with the mountains and stuff. It's a neat area.
Yeah, I'm gonna, this is around the time of year where I head home for Thanksgiving and also the circuit event in Cherokee, and I always have mixed feelings about this time of year, because I have to leave this sunshine to go to the bitter cold of the South in the winter. But I do get to see family and friends that I hadn't seen in a while. So
it doesn't get that cold in Atlanta, does it?
I mean, you're from Baltimore, so to you it's probably not that cold. But I've acclimated to this desert weather, so it's going to be pretty bad for me. And it's not necessarily just the cold; it's like rain also.
Yeah,
which doesn't happen here.
Is that Robin we're hearing in the background, Nate?
Yeah. He's making his podcast debut, if that's okay.
Yeah, I think he might have snuck on once before, but
yeah.
No, it's nice to hear from him. Is he dressing up for Halloween?
He is not dressing up for Halloween. I am dressing up for Halloween, though.
As Batman, I assume?
Sorry?
As Batman, I assume?
No. Richard Nixon.
Oh, that's right. You told me that already.
Yeah.
Why did you assume Batman?
Because his son is Robin.
Oh,
he wouldn't even need the costume.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
But yeah, Richard Nixon's pretty good too.
Right.
People are probably astounded, Carlos, to hear that you're in a hotel, but I imagine it's not a very expensive one. Is this the one that you've stayed at before?
Actually, no. It is a little bit more expensive than that, but not much. The reason I stayed in this one is $200 a week. The one I was in before was like $25 a day. So this is only a little bit more expensive than that. But the reason I'm staying in this one is because I can stay on the weekends. Whereas the one that's $25 a night, it's only that price during the week.
Right.
And so Friday and Saturday go up. And the reason I need to be in this one is because I needed to stay in a Nevada hotel for 30 consecutive days so that I can establish residence and get my Nevada's driver's license. So that's why I did this. And that's complete now. So I just applied for my license, and as soon as we're done with this, I'm going to go to my P.O. box and hopefully it's in there. Right now I'm just riding around with the little certification paper they give you and my Georgia's license, kind of like driver's license, with the holes in it. But as soon as I get my Nevada license, anyway, I'm going back east, like I said, in a couple of days. But when I get back west, I'm not going back to this $200 one. I was only doing that to get the license. So once I come back, I'll go back to the $25 night hotel and then just do the van thing on the weekends. But having that license is pretty good because when I'm in Vegas, a lot of the Caesar properties, I can get like free parking for 24 hours. Mm. And that's perfect for me because I'll always at least leave once a day. So it's basically free parking for Vegas locals. And that's a lot better than like gambling for a diamond card.
Right.
Yeah.
I just got a new license also, and I had to do the same thing because, you know, I guess it's part of this Real ID Act now. They don't just give you a license in person. They give you like a slip of paper that a police officer, whoever, can scan if you get pulled over, and then they mail you a license to, I guess, verify your address. So I did this right before I went to play the tournament at Maryland Live, the World Poker Tour event that I played there. And I never get carded at casinos or anything. I mean, I'm 35. I think I look 35-ish. I don't look, you know, 20. No, I don't really get carded. But I went to dinner with former podcast guest Elena Stover, who is actually, I hope she won't be mad at me for saying this, she's actually older than I am, but she looks much younger.
Right.
And so when we came back in, we got carded. And I handed the guy my regular license, my expired license with the hole punched in it. And he's like, I can't let you in. This license is expired. And I was like, oh, crap. I hope he, like, whatever scanning thing he's using will work with it. It did. So it ended up being fine. But I was like, all right, you know, this is like dinner break for the tournament. So I'm like, well, that's not letting me in isn't going to work. Wow. I imagine I could have worked it out one way or the other. But it didn't end up being a big deal, but it was a momentary panic for me.
Yeah.
What's been going on poker-wise with you? It seems like you've been crushing these, it's not exactly a satellite, this thousandaire maker that you cash every night.
Yeah, I guess in live poker terms, they call them survivors. But it's basically just like a cash satellite where if you win one of the top spots, usually it pays 5 or 6 spots, you win $1,000. So yeah, that's another reason to smile. I have been doing pretty well online since the summer, and in preparation for the podcast, I kind of just went back and looked at some of the numbers. I don't do that very often, but to kind of like see the last 3 months in black and white definitely makes me happy. So that tournament is one that I started calling it the Carlos, because it's like I feel like I cash it at least half the time I play it, which is pretty good when I want to say it gets like usually gets around 75 players and pays like 6 spots. So thanks to the time I spent in Vegas with you and Dara O'Kearney discussing satellite strategy for the upcoming WSOP main event satellite that I was going to play this summer in Vegas, my satellite strategy is kind of like honed to a T right now, and I'm just kind of putting that strategy into action.
Anything, any tips that you're willing to share?
Fold a lot. And basically the thing is like once you do the math and realize that you have a stack that's pretty much like say 85-90% to cash, you should just fold everything from there. And the people I play against don't really realize that. So you see people kind of like going to war on the bubble with like queens in spots where if they just fold like for another orbit or two, the short stack will blind out eventually. But people, they try to play it like it's a tournament. It's like they're trying to, like in their mind, winning is like having the most chips when the thing is over.
Right.
And they're trying to do that. In my mind, winning is cashing with like one ante left. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
And I remember, because I think I was around when you and Dara were talking about at least some of this also. And, you know, I'm sure you're right that a lot of this is people just like not really understanding the format or, you know, fully appreciating how they should be adapting to it. But I do feel like there are some people who just like being a bully or whatever is fun for them. And essentially they're willing to, you know, knowingly say they might not appreciate how much they're sacrificing, but I think, you know, just the kind of people who like have a 2x starting stack or, you know, a 2x average stack to cash or whatever, and are just, you know, raising every pot or, you know, shoving a lot and stuff like that, and just like enjoy racking up a big stack, even though it doesn't do anything for you in a satellite. I think there are still some people where that's just like their idea of fun is doing that.
Yeah, and God bless those people. If it were not for them, I couldn't just sit back and just like fold my way into the money in these spots. Because if everybody did what I did, then it would be tougher. Because the way Dara put it is like the way satellites should play out is that the first guy. Let's see if I can remember this correctly. Like the first guy shoves and everybody else just folds everything.
Right.
And then the tournament ends when whatever person is unfortunate enough to be in the blinds at the point where they blind out.
Right.
That's pretty much how most satellites should play. And I've had one or two where that was the case, where I kind of like got to my stack where I felt comfortable. And I was like, okay, now I'll just fold into these short stacks, bust. But then the short stacks are shoving, and I'm folding. And the other guys are also folding, and so the short stacks never bust. And I was like, man, I need somebody. Like, I'm not calling with kings when somebody shoves on me. So I need some guy to, like, grow a pair and call with kings when they get shoved on so that this thing can end. And fortunately for me, they call with, like, eights or, like, 8-10 off in those spots. So yeah, The people that are trying to win make it possible for me in that spot.
Oh, their disastrous play is making Robin sad.
Yeah. That's the
as soon as you said AT, started crying.
Yeah. Sorry about that. A lot of people, even people who understand satellite play a little bit, they don't like to play them because they find it extra painful to bust right before right before the bubble. They just think that losing a satellite feels a lot worse. Are you immune from that?
I am for sure online because this thing runs every night, so it's not. And it's also. It's the difference between live tournaments and online tournaments anyway. It's like losing a live tournament just hurts like 10 times much more than online. So the event that we're talking about is online, and it doesn't affect me. But live, I definitely feel that way, especially in cases where there's not another event going that same day. Or at least the next day. For example, in Vegas this summer, I play the 1K and 2K WSOP main event satellites. Or I guess they call them the megas. And the ones that I play, they were running like the 1K during the day and then the 2K at night. So when I busted the 1K, a lot of times it was like right after the 2K had already started. So I bust and I just jump right back into another one and that would be fine. But if I was in some type of situation where I couldn't immediately get back into another tournament, I think bubbling a satellite definitely would hurt more so than bubbling a tournament, because the min cash in the satellite is so much more. So just financially, I mean, on a dollar basis, it's just it feels like I was one spot away from 10,000 if I bubble the WSOP satellite versus if I'm playing like, I don't know, some $300 tournament that I normally play. If I bubble that, then I was like one spot away from $300. So that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Maybe part of it is that people tend to play satellites that they're not quite rolled for. So like, I think I'm one of these people who... So, for example, I can't remember a lot of the bad beats that I've taken in bigger tournaments, but I definitely vividly remember, like, T-Soprano putting a beat on me on the bubble for a Copenhagen package, and probably, like, that, you know, whether I should have been firing that satellite, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have. So that could be part of it, that you're just playing within your role.
That's a good example, because the Copenhagen package, it's not just a tournament. It's like, it's a trip. It's like an experience. And I vividly remember playing an online satellite for a Punta Cana package. And some guy busted me on the bubble of that one. And it was like the most painful bust out of all time. And like, cause I was like, oh my God, I had this, like I could see the waves and the beaches in my I thought I had it. So this guy busted me, and then I go on Twitter and complain about being busted on the bubble of the satellite. And Leo Wolpert responds and says, oh, that was you? So Leo bubbled me on a satellite for a Punta Cana package, and I thought about unfriending him. But yeah, I agree. Busting those type of satellites are definitely more painful than busting like the Survivor, where it's just cash.
Well, and in case anybody was wondering if there's a Thinking Poker community collusion ring online, now we, yeah, even more definitively is not.
Yes.
You know, so I had stopped playing. I mean, I early in my career, I played some of those like satellites because PokerStars used to have them for like all the EPTs and stuff. And I did go to Barcelona on one of those packages. But in general, I found the satellites weren't really that good of a value because so much of the prize, I don't know if the Punta Cana one works this way, but so much of the prize is wrapped up in an expensive hotel room. Like to win a PCA package, I think the package is valued at like $15,000 or $16,000. I think it's $15,000 plus $1,000 cash or something. But then the tournament buy-in is only $10,000. So like $5,000 is going towards, the Atlantis is an expensive hotel, so that's an extreme example. But a lot of money gets wrapped up essentially in hotels that you, I'm sure, would not otherwise stay at.
I agree with that, and I think when I first started playing those, in my mind it was like, hey, you pay $50 to play the satellite against generally bad competition, and you know, you win a trip to the Dominican Republic, so that felt like a good idea to me at the time. But I think after that, this must have been 2-3 years ago, and I think just listening to you give that advice over the years kind of made me realize how bad of an idea that is. So I don't play them anymore, but at the time I didn't realize what you just said, and so basically I learned that from you, and I stopped playing those, but I'll still play, like, you know, the Cash Survivors, and also the satellites to events. Like, for example, I'm going to play the main event anyway, so like if I win that, then it's closer to a one-on-one basis versus somewhere like some Caribbean island that I have to travel to.
Right.
It's even better in tournaments or satellites where I can sell the seat, because now I'm even closer to a closer to like a cash basis, as opposed to like, you know, winning a vacation package. And that also makes it a little bit better as far as the idea of being double raked. That's something that I remember Andrew talking about over the years, where if you play a satellite to an event that you were going to play anyway, then you're basically just being double raked.
So let's say it's not a satellite and you're just a professional poker player, and if you win money playing tournaments, you're going to put some of it in the bank and you're going to put some of it to playing more poker tournaments to win more money. Those other poker tournaments are also going to have rake, but there we don't worry about double rake, right? And similarly, if you're just somebody who plays poker, maybe you're a pro, if you win money, you're going to take it to the store and buy an apple with it. Like, you pay rake on that apple, like you pay more than whatever it costs. Like, we don't think there's a double rake fallacy there, right? So just the fact that it's like a satellite structure and you sort of know what you're going to do with the money if you win it, like that can cause problems if you're playing for a tournament that's going to be very tough, or that you are under-rolled for, or whatever. But there's no specific problem of double rake in satellites as opposed to any other kind of poker. Unless the rake for the target tournament is very, very high. But that's just the problem of playing a tournament where there's high rake. It's not a double rake problem. So I think that's just a logical error if you think there's a double rake problem with satellites.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed if you picked that up from me. I feel like I know better now, but it's certainly plausible that a few years ago I said something like that.
Yeah, pretty sure it was on the podcast, but it may have been like my first or second episode. So to in your defense, it was like 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of just like calling things a tournament, and in a lot of ways this works in a way that's beneficial to us, because it drives people into tournaments they would never otherwise play. But just like calling something a satellite really changes the way people think about it. I remember, I want to say it was Johnny Bax, you know, Cliff Josephy, talking about back when he ran a more, I guess he probably still stakes some people, but they used to be a really big backer in the MTT world. And he was talking about, people would say, oh, can you put me in this $10,000 tournament? And he's like, no, I don't think you're going to be plus EV in that. And like, well, can you put me in the satellites? Like, right. That would somehow, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think people just start thinking irrationally about it because it's called a satellite, and they feel like, and the analogy I like to use is like doing an end run around your bankroll, where like if you're not bankrolled for the target tournament, somehow winning the seat in a satellite like makes it okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you haven't played any live poker since Vegas?
No, I haven't. There was an event I was going to play. And believe it or not, there's some, I thought, decent tournaments in Laughlin. Well, when I say some, I mean one. And because usually they're really bad. Like, the worst one I saw was like a $35 buy-in with $13 rake.
I thought it was going to be 15.
No, it's like, well, the rake is included in the buy-in. So it's really a, what is that?
A 22 and 13.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, oh my God, I can't believe people play this. And and so I would never play that, but then I saw an advertisement for one that was like they do a once a month $200 tournament. And the rake is high, but it's still it's on par with like the 360 lives at WSOP circuit events. So it, that was doable. And I thought about playing it, but I went there and I saw the structure sheet and it was horrible. Like the blinds basically like double every level. It was like 20 minute levels and then the blinds just double every single level. And I was like, no, I'm not going to play that. So I didn't play. And I don't think I've played anything in Vegas since the summer. So I'm considering stopping by Choctaw on my way east. But really, that just depends on when I leave. I may end up leaving after Choctaw is over. And if that's the case, Cherokee will be my first live event since Vegas.
And you're going to be driving then from?
Yeah. So I'm driving from Laughlin over to Atlanta, and I'm actually driving in my brand new used Knitmobile.
Oh, new. I was about to ask. I was like, how many cross-country trips does that $3,000 van have in it?
So I bought this $3,000 van in 2015, and I think at the time it had 175,000 miles on it, and I had it for 2 years and I put like 80,000 miles on it, and it finally died recently, and so I just bought another one, and this one I paid $2,500 for, and it has 100,000 miles on it, and so I'm gonna try to see if I can get 150,000 miles out of this one. So it's the same color, and I think the same model year. The only difference is actually the first van was a Chrysler Town and Country, and this one is a Dodge Caravan. But from what I understand, they're kind of basically built on the same framework. I don't know the exact mechanical words for it, right. But I've been told they're basically the same.
It's kind of like skins for a poker network, I think.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. And the good thing about it is that the Caravan is like the, I guess, the more inferior of the two. And so I got a slightly better, I paid less for it, even though this one had fewer miles on it. And so I'm going to be driving this one, hopefully, you know, 10 times across the country over the next 4 or 5 years. Like, my whole philosophy in life since I started driving is that if I can get a year out of a car, then that's good. So this is probably, the Knitmobile is probably the first vehicle I've ever had that lasted more than a year. And I generally pay like, and it was also the biggest expenditure I ever had for a vehicle. So I paid $3,000 for it. Before that one, I think $1,500 was probably the most I ever paid for a vehicle.
Did you see that ad? I retweeted it a while ago. It was somebody was selling like a $500 car on Craigslist, and essentially he's like, look, you know, don't come talking to me about this light's on, that light's on. It's a $500 car. There's going to be some lights on.
Yeah, I did see that. That was hilarious. Yeah, it was like, when they say as is, they mean it at that price point.
Do you enjoy the cross country drive? Like, seeing the country, is that the kind of thing that you like?
I do, especially in the Southwest, and I know Nate can attest to this. Like, driving through New Mexico is amazing.
Yeah.
Arizona, New Mexico, I really like. Texas gets a little weird with all the stench from the cow butts. But once you get through there, I mean, right past Texas, that's fine also, but it's not, I don't know, like, I guess growing up in Georgia, I'm used to, like, trees, and so that does nothing for me. And like being on in the Southwest where there's less trees and I can just see like vast areas of land and the mountains, like that is more inspirational for me. So I like driving on this part of the country than on the other side.
And speaking of rake, the roads are all so straight. You know you're getting, like, it might be a long drive, but if two cities are, like, 200 miles apart, the road between them, you're driving 200 miles. None of this, no curves. Like.
Right. And in this part of the world, there's also a lot of downhill driving, which is great for us hypermilers.
I think maybe we talked about this before, maybe even with Tommy, but I've been infuriating people with my very mild hypermiling, which is mostly just like drifting towards stoplights that are already red. You know, I just like, I won't step on the gas to speed up to get there, and it drives people bananas. Like, they just want to get to like wait in line faster.
You know what? I thought about this the other day. One thing about driving long distances like that is like you give your mind a lot of time to think, and I come up with like some pretty good ideas when I'm driving in that state of mind. And one of them is that the guys who are like racing to be the first person to stop at the red light are almost synonymous with the guys who are trying to get first place in satellites.
Right. Yeah.
It was like there's absolutely no extra benefit to all this last minute aggression. Like, just, you know, folding aces and kings in spots where you don't need to play them is a good analogy for like throwing it in neutral and just coasting to the stop sign, to the red light.
Yeah, or just for like staying in your lane. I mean, my understanding anyway is, you know, it's a lot of the worst accidents that aren't caused by drunk driving. I guess even ones that are, you know, caused by drunk driving, it's still sort of the proximate cause, is people changing lanes. Like that's kind of when you're in the most danger. And in general, I don't think it really does you that much good. I mean, if you're on a really long drive and you can get around someone who's going slowly, but so many people, I feel like I see this more on the East Coast, just like change lanes so aggressively in situations where the bottom line difference it's going to make on like how quickly they get to their destination is quite small relative to whatever, like if they could actually see the risk, the quantity of risk that they're taking on as a result of making aggressive lane changes. But yeah, there's just sort of that momentary like, I feel antsy and I want to do this, and there's not really like an EV calculation behind it. It's just like, rrr.
Yeah. You know, people are over aggressive in so many areas of their lives, I think.
Well, on that note, do you want to talk about this hand that you sent?
Yeah. Speaking of over aggressive, let's talk about this hand. And you know what? This is another thing I was going to mention about the satellite strategy. You asked me like basically like a general, like what am I doing in those? For the people who listened to the last episode that I was on, that I talked about Car Loose, I basically just let Car Loose play the early levels to build the big stack. And then, you know, that song, Jesus Take the Wheel, it's like, Carlos, take the wheel. So at the end of the tournament, Carlos hands it over to Carlos, and then he coasts to the red light. And so
we have next year's T-shirt, by the way.
Yeah.
Carlos, take the wheel. So this is a hand where
Can I do a TPE ad before you do that?
Okay.
All right. If you want even more tournament poker strategy, including satellite strategy, but also much, much more than satellite strategy, sit-and-go strategy, MTT strategy, anti-up strategy, progressive knockout strategy, lots of different tournament formats from myself, from Carlos, from Nate, from lots of other people who have been guests on the Thinking Poker podcast, and probably some who will be guests on the Thinking Poker podcast in the future, then you want Tournament Poker Edge. You can sign up for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. Okay, take it away, Carlos.
Okay, so we're in traffic. Carlos is driving. Carlos is in the back of the Knitmobile sleep, and so this is an example of what Carlos is doing in the early and middle, more so the middle stages of the tournament. So this was an online tournament that I played. This one is a 4K guarantee. I can't remember the buy-in, maybe like $20 or something. And I have King Jack offsuit in the big blind, and we're at the 400, 800 level with an 80 ante. And villain limps under the gun from a, I guess that's a 35-ish big blind stack. And just a little backstory, I've seen him do this before with 3 deuce suited and 7-6 offsuit. And action falls around to the small blind who completes from a 5K stack, so he has like six bigs. And with the King Jack offsuit, I decide to raise here. Like, basically, I've seen this guy limp garbage, and this is basically something I'm doing, and this is my main focus at this start area of the tournament, is to identify these people who are playing wide capped ranges passively, and then just attack them. And so that's what I decided to do here. This is a pretty good hand for it, but I can go a lot wider than this. This time I decided to make it 2400. Again, we're at the 400, 800 level. I make it 2400, and the guy who limped under the gun decides to call, and the small blind folds.
Sorry, the effective stack is 35 big blinds?
Yes.
And except against the small blind where it's 6?
Right.
Did you consider jamming?
No. I don't know if the risk reward is there against the original limper. So against him, I'm basically risking 35 big blinds to pick up about 4, a little bit less than 4. So in the rare case that this guy's trapping, I don't know if that is the risk reward I want to take. If I had say like 15K here, or maybe even a little bit more than that, I think I would have jammed.
Sure. And did you consider raising a bit more to get more immediate money for playing a stronger hand than this guy's range? Not saying you should. I mean, you're the guy who crushes these tournaments, and I'm not. I'm just asking.
my thought process is I'm not really playing my hand for its value. Let's see if the hot and cold value, I think, is the I think I was trying to steal a term from Nate from a couple of episodes ago. But I'm basically playing this hand as a bluff. My hand, I'm raising here because I know this guy is not going to have a strong enough range to stand up for 3 barrels. And so I kind of want to, like, I want to drag him to the river and drown him. And in order to do that, I don't want to bloat the pot so much preflop to where he's going to be priced in to call the river bet.
Yeah, that's great forward thinking. So,
yeah. Yeah, I found the preflop, and again, not saying that it's bad, but it was something that jumped out at me as, and I think part of it is I'm not often playing with people who are, you know, making exactly this sort of mistake or whatever. Because I think generally my advice to people is to, you know, choose a raise size here where there's some chance under the gun 2 might actually fold to your raise. So like when you have strong hands, you're happy to make a larger raise and put more money in the pot. And when you have weaker hands, you're happy to give yourself, you know, some chance of having fold equity. I just to kind of try to put my own terms where I see your value coming from here, and you can let me know if this seems right to you. So part of it, I think, is just driving small blind out of the pot. Like, even if Under the Gun 2 never folds to this raise, which is probably the case, and even if you're not pushing an equity advantage against him, which you probably are, but even if you're not, I think just, like, pushing small blind out of the pot and getting to play heads up against Under the Gun 2 is a pretty good outcome for you, as long as you don't get re-raised too often. But then also, it sounds like what you're saying is you're kind of setting up a scenario where you actually want him playing a wider range to the river, because he's going to end up folding too often later in the hand, and that's going to be a more expensive mistake than if you just, like, collect the preflop pot or force a slightly larger preflop pot.
Right. I think you described it accurately. Just looking at the hand now, I think another consideration of mine in this spot is that I want it to, because the small blind is so short, if I wanted to kind of give him an opportunity to, like if he limp shoves, I want that to open up the betting again, and I'm not good enough with the math to know.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, so, like, I know if I make it 4,000 here, this guy has 5,000. So if I make it 4,000 and he shoves, I can't reshove.
Right. You could probably make it like 28, but yeah, you don't want to go too big to the point where he doesn't reopen the betting.
Right. Now, if that wasn't a consider, like, normally in this spot, I would be looking to go like 28 or maybe even like 32. And that's something that we discussed when we did the Twitch stream together from your place in San Francisco. I think I was ISOing limpers a little bit too small. So normally I would go like four bigs or five bigs here, to your point. But in this case, that was probably the consideration, is to leave room for the reshove if the small blind shoved.
Yeah, makes sense.
All right. So here, again, we make it 2,400. The under the gun limper calls. Small blind folds. I got some. Never mind. I'll tell you in a minute. and the flop comes 7-4 deuce rainbow. And again, I have king jack offsuit.
And I think some people will be tempted to look at this and say, well, look, you've seen this guy limp 3 deuce suited. You've seen this guy limp 7-6 offsuit. This seems like his flop and not your flop.
Right, exactly. Okay, the reason I paused a second ago, because somebody pulled up beside me, and, like, they were kind of looking at me like, what the hell is that guy talking about? and I wanted to wait for them to walk away before I said that, because they could hear me. But yeah, that's just the kind of thing that happens when you're in the Bitmobile. So this guy, yeah, it is his flop, but by his flop, that means, yeah, he's going to have two pairs sometimes. He's going to have set sometimes. But if this is flop, he's also going to have three deuce, a 5-4, or 7-6. Like, all those type of, he's going to hit this flop more than me, but he's not going to hit it strong enough to deal with the later street barrels.
And he's also going to have a bunch of, like, 9-8 off, jack 10 off. Like, he's going to have a bunch of hands that miss the flop also. I think that's one thing a lot of people tend to miss, is they just think about the ways, like, weird ways the opponent could have smacked the flop, and don't think about all the ways that he could have missed the flop.
Right. It's like a seeing monsters under the bed, I think, a little bit. And, like, I've kind of gotten to the point now where I'm kind of disappointed if he misses it completely, because now I'm just going to win the $6,000 pot. if he has like 5-4, I'm going to win like a $15,000 chip pot. So I want him to hit it a little bit. And based on the fact that his starting range is so weak, he's most times when he hits it, he's only going to hit it a little bit. He's not going to just nail this flop every time. So yeah, that's a, like, monsters under the bed mentality. So again, 7-4 deuce rainbow. I have king jack, and I just see bet half pot, and the guy calls. So I'm thinking, you know, he has basically all those suited connectors, all the small pairs, at this point, I think if he has like broadways, he would just fold those. So, as far as monster hands, I think he could still have like a set or two pair. People don't always raise those on the flop, so I think I can still leave that stuff in his range. But I think the majority of his range is like a 7, a 4, 5, 6, like just all kinds of garbage. Gut shots, a deuce. Like I see people like limp ace deuce and then call a c-bet on this board. And so like he still has a bunch of like marginal hands in his range. Probably not a lot of air, but some marginal hands for sure. So the turn is a 9 of spades. There's now around 12,500 in the middle. And I decide to c-bet half pot again. If he has like a 4 or a 7, then 9 puts some pressure on him. So that's going to be, besides the rare monsters, I think the top of his range is going to be going to feel a little bit of pressure from an overcard coming now. So A7, he'll probably call again, but because this board is so low, there's a good chance that another overcard comes on the river. So when the majority of his range, of his bluff catching range, is basically medium pairs, I think we're in a good spot to bluff him off that by the river. So I bet again, and he calls again. Now, this turn call is key, because like I said, if he had like pocket sevens, fours, or deuces, or 7-4, I can see him just calling the flop. He's not going to just call the turn with hands like that. So when he just calls the turn, now I think he has almost no monsters in his range. And like we just said, his bluff catchers are pretty weak bluff catchers. And so now I think I got him right where I want him. So I bet he calls, and now there's 25,000 in the middle, and he has 17,000 left, which is a little bit more than 20 bigs, because again, we're at the 400, 800 level. The river is the 8 of hearts, which really is this is where I used to kind of get in that same monsters under the bed mentality, because now I'm thinking, oh God, if he had 5-6, which is very plausible, he would play it this way, I think. 5-6 got there. 8-7 is another hand that he would play that way that got there.
I'm ashamed to say this was a lot of my thinking when I watched this hand before the conversation. That was like, oh, a lot of my thoughts are what you're describing right now.
Right. This is one of the worst cards. But because this guy's starting range is so wide, there's still I can basically put two monsters in his range now, 5-6 and 8-7. The rest of his range, which is still pretty wide, isn't they're not strong enough to call this river shove. And so yeah, he could have 5-6, but he can also have 7-6 or, you know, 6-4 or pocket sixes. So I am going to get called, obviously, if he has 5-6 or 8-7, but in my estimation, that's probably like 20% of his range, if that. And so when I bet this river, I'm basically shoving 17K into 25. That bet needs to work less than 50% of the time. I think it's like 42. I did the analysis on this earlier, but I don't remember the exact number, but it's somewhere around like 42, 45% of the time. And I think it's going to bet, I think the bet needs to work roughly that amount of time. And I think it's going to work almost twice that, like 80% of the time. So this is the spot where I want, like, this is the the whole point of this hand is to set this guy up for this big river mistake. And so I kind of like the smaller raise preflop to kind of like entice him to continue to this point on where he's going to make a bigger mistake on the river, hopefully. And so I shove the river and he folds. But again, I think he's going to call with 8-7, 5-6. Those are obvious candidates. If he somehow has, if he has a 9 that, if he has 9-7, I think he raises a turn. If he turned 2-pair, I think he would have raised. If he has a 9 that isn't 2-pair, if somehow he called the flop with, say, 9-8 is another one. Maybe he calls the flop with 9-8 for some reason, maybe 9-8 of clubs or something, where he has backdoor 3-2 a straight and 3-2 a flush. Obviously, he'll call with that hand also. And I'm having a hard time coming up with any other 9s that, like, I guess just dry 9s. Like, I don't think he calls the flop with, like, ace 9. But if he did, he would maybe call the river with this hand also. But even with that being the case, I still don't think he's calling enough to make this river shove unprofitable. And so in order to make this shove unprofitable, I think he's got to call with, like, some pocket sixes, or maybe, like, a 4 if he has it for, like, 4th pair. And I think that's just going to be hard to do. If he somehow got here with 7-6, is he going to call a river shove with 7-6? I don't think so. So if he's not calling with just 3rd pair or worse, then I don't think he's going to be calling enough to make this bet unprofitable. All right, so because this hand was on Ignition, I switched back over to Bovada, but it's basically the same thing. The same, it's two different skins on the same network. And both of those skins allow you 24 hours after the tournament to download a hand history to see all the hands in the tournament, see all the whole cards, whether it went to showdown or not. So even though this guy folded, I was able to find out what he had. And he had ace 5 of diamonds. So he basically limped the suited ace from under the gun. And on the flop, he had, it was 7-4 deuce with 1 diamond. So he had a gut shot and backdoor flush draw. And then the turn, and I expect to get called by hands like that from these guys. Like, they're never going to, like, raise the flop with a hand like that. They generally are going to just call. And then on the turn, he didn't improve at all. I would expect most people to fold their hand on the turn, but this guy decided to call it again, and obviously he couldn't call the river shove with just ace high. But because they're willing to call that first bet with those type of hands, that mistake is what set them up for these type of impossible situations for them on later streets. So that's one of the reasons I love playing on this site, because a lot of times, in addition to making money, like, this is such a valuable learning tool to see the way the average person on the site plays.
This is also, I mean, it's a good metric for, like, when you should bluff is if you can't even beat busted draws and your opponent can have busted draws, there's a pretty good chance you should be bluffing.
Right, right.
Like, it's not even a matter of folding him off of medium strength hands. It's like, in his mind, he has nothing, but he might still win the pot if you don't bet. Like, it's almost always profitable to bluff in a spot where your opponent could have nothing that's still better than your nothing.
Right, right. And another thing that I failed to mention in the earlier discussion of this hand is this was a pretty good candidate to start with to make this play. Turns out that this board gave me very little hope to win this hand without bluffing, but I'm also doing this same thing with Jack 10, obviously, or say like 10-9. And so sometimes I'll start with the intention of bluffing, but occasionally I'll backdoor into a real hand.
Yeah, and, I've heard that called a semi-bluff.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I think I'm going to credit you with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's see if we can get that to catch on.
Yeah, I mean, but generally, people, when they say semi-bluff, it's like betting with a flush draw. But what I'm saying is like, I'm basically betting with nothing. Like, if I have Jack 10 and I bet on this board, I'm not, in my mind, semi-bluffing. But it's shouldn't there be like a minimum amount of equity for it to be called a semi-bluff?
Yeah, like, I mean, all terminology sort of falls apart at the margins.
Yeah, I was semi-bluffing with my 5% equity.
Yeah, I think when it comes to analyzing, the results of a bluff like this, I think one trap a lot of people fall into is they get some of the outcomes you're just talking about. Like, they get called by 5-6, and they're like, oh, I'm such an idiot. That was such a bad spot to bluff. In retrospect, it's so obvious he has 5-6. You know, so, like, a 5-6 is not the hand, obviously, that you're trying to bluff him off of, or, like, 8-7 or something like that. I mean, the real question is, how often is he going to have the hands that he would actually fold? Like, it's not like you're shoving here thinking he couldn't possibly have a strong hand. So I think that the time when you kind of need to reconsider, if you get called here by 5-4, then you start to think, oh, maybe I chose the wrong guy to try to do this against. But yeah, getting called here by 5-6 is more like bad luck than any indication that you made a bad shove.
Right. I recommend the I don't remember the exact name of it, but the bluffing series that you did on TPE,
Tournament Poker Ed,
where you talked about, I guess, bluff targets. Like, I'm so used to the phrase value target, but I guess bluff target doesn't roll off the tongue as easily. So I'm not even sure if that's the phrase you used, but there's plenty of bluff targets in this guy's range that we can get to fold with this river bet.
Yeah, I think the other common mistake this highlights, highlights by not making, is a lot of people kind of complain, and this is one of the things I complain about a lot with people kind of exclusively play small stake stuff, and then they're like, well, all this fancy poker strategy stuff doesn't help me any because my opponents are terrible and none of that stuff works and they all never fold and this kind of thing. And there's some truth to that. Like, there are certain situations where there are certain hands you shouldn't be trying to bluff people off of, but I think a lot of people just don't really apply enough pressure with their bluffs, and then either the person makes like a slightly bad call or possibly even a correct call because you just didn't actually apply that. I mean, people bet like half pot on the flop and then check the turn and then bet half pot on the river and they get called by like third pair and like, oh, well, that guy's such a fish. It's like, well, you didn't really put that much pressure on him. Like, you made it pretty easy for him to take his hand to showdown. And I think this is a good indication of kind of like having a plan and committing to it, having a mathematical understanding of why you expect the plan to be profitable, rather than just kind of like throwing some chips in the pot when, in your opinion, your opponent has shown weakness, which part of the problem with that is that your opponents tend to also know when they've shown weakness. So the idea that like it's just better to bluff in spots where my opponent has shown obvious weakness is not necessarily true, because a classic example of this is like the guy raises pre-flop and then checks an ace-high flop or something. Like, yeah, it probably indicates that he's not thrilled with the flop, but at the same time, he knows that he's showing that weakness, and so there's a decent chance that he's like expecting to call down at least some bluff. He's probably not check folding the flop. So I mean, if you just bet once and then check it down, you're like, oh, I have this guy call me with kings, I could have had an ace, like you need to either give him a big bluff, like bigger than what he's expecting, or none at all. But just kind of doing something in the middle is like exactly what those people are looking for when they take a sort of obviously weak line like that.
Right. And your, like, the way you put it just now is like when the guy hits an ace and he checks back, like he's looking to like he's not in love with his hand and he's looking to like call some bets. That's like really another way of putting that is like, okay, the guy, when he checks back, he probably wouldn't do that with two pair better, and so his decent top pair is towards the top of his range, and so he can't fold to later bets, otherwise he's going to be really exploitable. They're not putting it in those terms, but that is why they're vulnerable to this. Like, this guy, when he limps in pre-flop, and just calls over all these streets, a seven, like 7-6 is towards the top of his range. And so he's not saying, oh, I got to call with this seven because otherwise I'm gonna be exploitable. He's just thinking like, well, I guess he has it. It's like another phrase I heard from you was when guys call down like this with weak hands, they're basically drawing to a check. Like if he calls his turn with 7-6, he's calling in hopes that I'm not going to shove the river. And when they play against me, they're basically drawing to checks that just never come.
Right.
And so that's basically what Carlos is doing all day long. And a lot of it this is like the sexy part of it is like seeing a triple barrel bluff work. But the behind the scenes part of it is in the early levels, I'm folding a lot and I'm paying attention. And I'm noticing that this guy limped under the gun with 3 deuce suited and 7-6 offsuit. And I pretty much identify the type of person that this will work against, and then I'll do it to that type of person. If this is the guy who I've seen limp and just like not raise post-flop with like queens in a spot like this, then I don't go for it against him. And so that the groundwork has to be there before you can do stuff like this, I think.
Yeah, and one other thing I'll add here, when you're playing live poker, if you have any familiarity with reading people or tells or stuff like that, and I can recommend Zach Elwood, who we've had on this show, one of our very first guests, who wrote like Reading Poker Tells, Verbal Poker Tells, Exploiting Poker Tells, is kind of a whole series that I think is really good. But oftentimes you can get a sense of how people are calling, whether or not they plan on calling blank rivers. They're just like the speed with which they call the turn or the confidence with which they call the turn. This is like one of the best times to be looking for like strong means weak sorts of tells, where you get to the river and the guy like grabs calling chips and is like making sure you see that he has chips in his hand. It's just like all these sorts of things that people do to so like live poker, you even get this added layer of information, because I think what you're saying is very good in terms of when they call the turn, they're usually capped. Like they would have raised their monster hands on the turn. So, you kind of, if you're playing live poker, you want to be alert for either an indication that your opponent might be slow playing, if it is like a lot of drama before he calls the turn or something like that, look for reactions to the river card as well, because that's, I think, the biggest thing that could go wrong for you here is if your opponent drills the river. So, you really want to be watching his reaction when that river card comes down. And you don't need... You're really just looking for the absence of a reaction. Like, unless you get some indication of like he just drilled it, then your plan is to shove. I think there's that whole extra layer of live tells. This is like the kind of situation where I think those can be really useful, how they call the turn and what their reaction is to the river card.
Right. It's like they're performing for a check. Like they're trying to like earn a check with their acting skills.
Right.
Like by staring at you real mean. Or it's like, so yeah, I agree that a lot of that stuff comes into play. The other thing I want to say here is I used to be one of those guys that said the type of thing that you mentioned earlier, which is you can't do this kind of stuff at low stakes because these people are calling stations and it just doesn't work against them. There is some truth to that, but I think the nuance that a lot of people are missing when they make that statement is that that's true in the early levels when they have a lot of chips. It's like, you're not going to bluff too many people off of anything they want to call with when they're 200 big blinds deep. But once you get into the middle stages and your bluffs start to represent like larger portions of their stack all the way up to this river where you're basically putting them all in, even these calling stations will tighten up once they realize, like, man, I've been in this tournament for 3 or 4 hours. I got a pretty decent stack. And this Nick guy who hasn't played any hands in the early levels, all of a sudden, is just going crazy and betting all three streets. And I could fold here, and I'll still have more than 20 big blinds. And so that kind of thought process goes through their mind at this point where, like, if this hand occurred at, say, instead of 400, 800, if this was at like 40, 80, and I couldn't put them all in on the river, I would never do this, because I think I would get called by Ace Four, because like the people said, these guys are bad, they're calling stations, and you can't bluff them. You can't bluff them for like less than 100% of their stack. That's the nuance that a lot of people are missing, I think. But once you start putting in 100% of their stack, if you do a good job of identifying the weak cap range, you can bluff them almost 100% of the time.
Yeah, so you kind of stole my question, because I'm getting nostalgic these days and thinking about talking strategy with you 4 years ago as opposed to now. You've come an enormous like ways. How does that feel?
Feels great, man. TPE trade. definitely feels great. It's like I definitely feel more like I'm not as lost when I'm hearing better players discuss things now. So like in the past, you know, with my, I guess, entry level understanding of like the workings of poker, it was more like confusion and making notes to myself to like figure out what that means later when people talked about things like ranges and how often bets needed to work, and it being okay if it doesn't work as often as the math says. I'm sorry, like, okay, this last part, I don't know how to put it in words, but I can put it in numbers, I guess. Like, when I shove this river, if this, the only way this river shove is bad is if this guy is calling me more than whatever the number was, I think 42% of the time. So if he's calling me, let me make sure I'm getting this right. Okay, I need this bet to work 42% of the time. So if I shove and it works 30% of the time, okay, I'm screwing this math up way bad here because I'm distracted by the guy walking towards me with a screwdriver. But he was, I think he's working on something on the ground here. But, and this may not even be a good example. I'm so far down the rabbit hole right now. But like basically, if you bet here, and you guys can correct me if this math is not right. If I get called 50% of the time here,
yeah, you're still showing a profit.
Right. And so that type of mentality is not something that I had before. It's like, even if this bet, like, in my mind, to make this play, this bet needs to work, like, 80% of the time. And, like, without even thinking about the math of it, that's how it feels to a new player. Like, if I know I can shove here and I lose 50% of the time, and that's still a good thing. Like, that's not something that most beginning players, including myself, 4 years ago, could conceptualize.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have such a strong attachment to how they bust out of tournaments or how they lose a lot of chips in tournaments, where if they, I mean, and I guess I've admitted to stuff like this in the past as well, but you know, if they lose with a good hand, even if it wasn't a good spot. So like, I think a common place you see this is when people are shallow, they have like 12 big blinds or something, and they'll jam pocket sixes into an under the gun raise before they'll open jam like a jack eight suited from the cutoff. Even though, you know, it's a much more plus EV play in most situations to open jam the jack eight suited from the cutoff than it is to jam sixes into another gun open. But they would just like, they would rather have a pair when they go, like, they don't want to wait for a good spot. They just want to wait for a good hand. And I think it's the same sort of thing tends to happen with bluffing. Like, if people lose because they got coolered, or even it wasn't really a cooler, like they had aces and they didn't want to fold it and they lost to, you know, maybe a set they actually could have gotten away from. But if they like go out with aces versus a set, they can just tell themselves like, okay, that was bad luck. But if they go out on a bluff, then they feel like they did something wrong, and they're like, oh, I you know, got impatient, I got stupid, I think people just have like opinions about how they want to go out of tournaments, and the more you can let go of that, the better.
Yeah, you have to, it's like football, it's like, in order to win, you have to be willing to punt. And I think that's something that I've started to do more so lately, is just being willing to punt, like find a good spot. And by punt, I mean, like, you know, basically put all your chips in as a bluff. And some people think of that word as like, okay, basically spew off in a bad spot. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying basically what I did here. Like, if I shove here and I get called by like 5-6, a lot of people who are kind of thinking on that beginner mentality, they would say, God, Carlos just punted this tournament away. But yeah, you got to be willing to do that, because you're only going to lose like 20% of the time when you do this. 80% of the time you're going to win, and it's almost better than getting it in. Like, there's people who wouldn't want to do this, the play that I made in this hand, but they'd much rather get in like queens against ace king. And because that's, like you said, you're getting it in with a good hand. You're basically doing something that even the best players in the world would do. And so, like, there's no fault. But really, I'd rather make this move and win 80% of the time than get it in with queens against ace king and only win 50% of the time.
Right. Yeah. And I think part of that just comes down to being confident that this is actually a good play, you know, whereas you can be sure if you get it in queens versus ace king, you can say, well, there was nothing differently I could have done there. And that's true, versus a spot like this. And I think that's why, like, understanding the math is helpful, because then you can, even if you do get called by 5-6, you can kind of go back and, you know, make some assumptions or use card runners EV or whatever, and kind of look at the math behind the play and say, okay, my assumption is if he folds these hands but calls with these ones, then shoving is profitable. And then all you have to ask yourself is, how confident am I in these assumptions? So I think, like, having that plan and understanding the math behind the play, rather than, you know, a lot of people when they're bluffing, they just tend to, it's just sort of like, oh, I would like to win this pot. And they bet the flop. And then they're like, oh, now the pot's even bigger. Now I want to win it even more. And then they bet the turn. And they're like, oh, crap, I have, you know, 40% of my stack in there. I really need to win this pot. And they shove the river. So then when it's just kind of like an impulsive thing rather than a calculated move, I guess it is hard to be sure whether or not that was the right play, because, you know, you can't judge based on the results. Like, whether or not you get called doesn't really tell you whether it was a good play, and you have nothing else to go on because you're not aware of whatever, you know, math was underlying the play. So I think having that math to fall back on is helpful in situations where it doesn't work, to, you know, not lose sleep over it, or, you know, be able to explain yourself to backers or whatever.
Right. And the beautiful thing about poker, man, is if it doesn't work, you just res another tournament and do it again. And eventually it'll work. And because I'm willing to do that now, so I win this hand, and now I have like 60 bigs, and I'm putting myself in a position to actually win this tournament. Whereas in the past, by not taking spots like this, I'm constantly like blinding out or get into that push-fold stage of the tournament earlier than others. And like, my ceiling a lot of the times when I played that way was min cashing. Like, that was almost like the goal. Either like, my range was small. Like, I was never going to like punt in the early stages and be out, but I was never going to take the risk of punting to get a stack big enough to go into the deeper stages. So my range of results was either a min cash at the top end, or just like slightly bubbling like right outside of the money on the low end. Now my range is like either winning or busting like level 4. And I think that is probably the better approach when you're talking about tournaments, because all the money is up top.
I hope I haven't. Do you have another minute, Carlos, if I tell a story?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I hope I haven't told the story on here before. But over the summer, one of my students made day 3 of the WSOP main event, and he had played day 2A, so he had that day 2B off, and he wanted me to come, you know, meet him and kind of help him prepare for day 3, which I was going to do since I was already out of the tournament. And somehow it came up that I had never played craps, and so he really wanted me, he was like, he wanted my beginner's luck, essentially. But that was how he put it. He wanted me to come roll the dice, and he would get my beginner's luck. So I went, I met him at the craps table at his hotel, and you know, we played at the craps table for maybe half an hour or something, and some portion of that was me rolling. So first, my reaction to craps is, I feel like I rolled pretty well. I mean, not skill-wise well, but I think I rolled maybe like 12 times or something before I crapped out, and he didn't win that much. Like, I was kind of amazed. I was like, that was a pretty good run, and that's all the profit you got? Like, I feel like we had a pretty well above average run there for you to win that little. That didn't seem right to me. So then we're doing that, and he's doing all this stuff. You know, he's tipping dealers, and he's talking about this is lucky and that's lucky, and roll it this way, it's luckier if you do this. And the whole reason we're there, so he has my beginner's luck when I'm rolling, all this like gambly luck kind of talk. And then we go over and we start talking about strategy for day three, and I'm trying to explain to him, we're talking through some hands from day two or some spots. I was trying to explain why I thought he should have bluffed in the spot, and he's like, well, what if the guy has an ace? I was like, yeah, I mean, if he does, then you're going to lose. But like, I don't think he's going to have it often enough to make that unprofitable. And he's just like, but I don't want to risk it. I don't want to gamble. It's like, we literally were just overrolling dice. And now I'm telling you, these are spots where it's actually profitable for you to gamble, and you're not willing to do it. Like,
yeah. I mean, that's such a good way of understanding poker. It's like, it's a gambling game. It's just a plus EV gambling game. And there's so many people, including myself, a couple of years ago, is like, I didn't want to gamble. And that is not the right mentality in a tournament, but it is the right mentality in the late stages of a satellite, if you've gotten to the point where you can afford not to gamble. But if you're playing MTTs, it's like, yeah, you're getting the opportunity to take plus EV gambles. So you can't turn that down.
Well, thanks so much, Carlos, for taking the time to talk to us. It was good to talk to you again.
Thank you. This is great as always.
Yeah, this was fantastic. Thanks so much.
And thank you to Robin. I was glad to get a chance to hear his voice for the first time.
Man, he loves your voice. He calmed right down.
I was going to say, really, Robin should be thanking you getting to listen to Carlos's voice.
Yeah. No, it's great. What's your rate for babysitting? Is it like, can I hire you to coach and then just have you babysit? Is that a thing? Maybe not. I don't know. That's
I wouldn't trust me with that type of response.
What pleasure as always, Carlos.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. Bye, guys. Cool. I was reminded that we didn't do an intro when you came back on and you said hello again in that Nate voice. I was like, oh, we didn't do an intro.
I'm trying to be good here. I'm trying to take the editor's audio, video, microphone.
All right, how's this? Is this better?
It got worse right after you did that.